You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com. We are brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves, and we are part of the Beautiful Game Network. It is Monday, July 26, 2021. Another weekend of Major League Soccer is in the books. We are in the midst still of the group stage over in Tokyo for the U.S. Women's National Team, and we've just got three games left, two match days left in the 2021 CONCACAF Gold Cup as the four matches in the quarterfinals took place this past weekend, and then we've got the semis on Thursday, and then the final at the Death Star in Las Vegas on Sunday. We've got a lot of Gold Cup stuff to talk about, but first let me bring my co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, how was it finally watching a Gold Cup game on television on the couch instead of in real life?
Slightly more hectic, because I was trying to deal with watching and covering a Sporting Kansas City Seattle Sounders matchup last night almost simultaneously. The first half for Sporting Kansas City ended, and I was able to flip over to the U.S. Women's National Team for about 15 minutes, and then as soon as Sporting Kansas City's first half or second half started, I watched that until the end of the game, and then of course, you know, Sporting ended up winning that one, and I flipped over to the U.S. Men's National Team match for the final 30, 40-ish minutes or so, and watch them get that winner with Matthew Hoppe at the last second. So we'll talk more about that game, but it was kind of nice to be at home. Wednesday night was my sixth game in the last, like, sixth game in the last 9 days, and I am very happy that I had 10 days off covering a game in person after that Sporting Kansas City draw with the San Jose Earthquakes on Wednesday, so I'll take the break.
Oh, good stuff. And then joining us tonight from her new digs down in the Sunshine State, Rachel Quicker. Rachel, how has it been being around and living amongst the Florida men?
Florida is definitely interesting. Haven't run into too many crazy Florida man stories or people yet, but no, it's good. I'm excited to be here. It's nice to live only an hour away from Exploria Stadium and the Orlando Pride and I almost said Atlanta United because that's I'm going to the game on Friday, but Orlando City FC, it's really cool. All settled in. I technically start my job on Sunday, but I did go this past Sunday night just to kind of see what I'm going to be doing, and you know, so I don't just jump in like with completely blindfolded. But it was good. It was excited. I'm excited to work with the teens and the young adults of the parish, and just slowly and surely getting used to being called a Floridian by my family.
Good stuff, Rachel. And then also, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong. Neither of us have actually been to Exploria Field, Exploria Park, Exploria Stadium. Rachel, how is it being amongst the pride? How is it being in the sea of purple?
Yeah, so it was cool, and it was interesting because the last time I went for Equalizer Soccer, which specifically covers women's soccer, I was in the press box, and that was back in June 2019. So it was cool to be, they have a beautiful press box. They have a wonderful facility. It was very cool to kind of watch the game from that vantage point. But this time I went as a photographer. That's something that I've been doing for a bunch of years. And it was crazy because I was so crazy nervous. I hadn't shot a game in about 2 years. And, I just felt it was weird. I felt like right at home. It was awesome. They didn't have the biggest crowd. I think that one of the reasons is because there are four players who are out for the Olympics, and those are kind of your what's marketable players, I guess, so to say. But it was cool. You know, the fans that were there brought a lot of energy. The Pride did lose to OL Reign, so that was kind of a bummer for the fans there. But it was really nice. The stadium is absolutely gorgeous. They have a wonderful setup for the photographers, and it was awesome.
Good stuff. And then I guess, listeners, we should be pointing out, Rachel and Trevor Tracy have done a good job covering, to the extent that we can, the U.S. women's national team over in the Olympics, with some, I'd say, very, very unreasonable, and at least for me as the only person on the podcast in his 30s, an inhumane kickoff time in terms of the hours that are taking place. But they've been doing a great job there, and Rachel will be back with me tomorrow after we recap the end of the group stage and look ahead to what's next for the U.S. women's national team and what has been a very up-and-down tournament so far for Vlaco and Ninofsky's ladies. But let's get on to the Gold Cup. We will handle the quarterfinal matches in chronological order. So the first game that took place on Saturday was Mexico dispatching Honduras by a score of 3-0. Dan, I'll throw it to you first. I'll say that this is the first game that I think we can comfortably say that Mexico looked like Mexico and looked like a clear favorite and the dominant A team in this tournament. Obviously no Chucky Lozano in this one, but Funes Mori gets the goal. Jonathan Dos Santos with a really great goal right before halftime. And then Osvaldo Pineda, also with a goal. They looked the part in terms of the performance, and they looked the part in terms of the scoreline given the opponent. It was really, really hard after Mexico had such a tough first game against Trinidad and Tobago, given the opponents they were going to play, that we could really be oppressed by anything other than like a 5 or a 6-0 kind of scoreline. This is a familiar Honduras team who has gone up against Mexico, and they've had some very tough physical battles. Honduras has gotten some results against them, albeit mostly in Honduras, in World Cup qualifying. This is a lesser version of Los Catrachos, but we wanted to see a performance. We wanted to see the bigger players step up for this team, and we wanted to see them win by a convincing and comfortable scoreline in the first half, and Tata Martino got that out of his team. Daniel, your thoughts?
Yeah, this was the most comprehensive performance from Mexico to date. I was thoroughly impressed with how they attacked. They were hunting the ball down in midfield. I think there was overall a very good sense of urgency from them, while at the same time a patience in making sure that the chances that they created were high quality goal scoring chances. I didn't feel like they did against Trinidad. It was a lot of helter skelter, just lump the ball into the box. Sure, they didn't really have a plan, with Chucky Lozano going out when he did in the match, but overall, you know, later on in the tournament, you saw them get a little bit more solid, in their overall game plan. And, you get a couple of good finishes from Funes Mori. And you get a heck of a volley from Jonathan Dos Santos, who hadn't played a huge part in the tournament so far for Mexico, and comes up and gets a wonderful volley that he places into the far, his left hand, goalkeeper's right hand bottom corner, a little worm burner across the field in, Glendale, Arizona. And it was Mexico was flying after that. And I think, Honduras wasn't at full strength either. There's no Albert Deliz, no Ravel Quioto. They were relying on Jerry Bankston, who's good, but doesn't have the firepower and the creativity and the technical ability that those other two do. And to be without those guys this match, I think, was always going to be incredibly difficult for Honduras. I think maybe with those guys, they are able to pin back Mexico a little bit. Mexico knew that they didn't have anybody that could beat them over the top. And I think that's how they defended. And defended so relentlessly in the middle third of the pitch, made it all over the place to try and sniff out passes, counter press like crazy, because they knew that Honduras had no speed to beat them with. So, a good coaching job by Tata Martino, to really get them up for this one. Best match we've seen from Mexico yet. Canada's gonna cause some problems for them because it's a little bit of a wider, feel, and they have some really good playmakers in the midfield, and Stephen Eustachio, who was very clearly, as we talk about Canada, very clearly missed in that matchup against U.S. men's national team. So it was interesting to see how it looks going forward, but I'm pretty impressed by this performance in Mexico. Still believe that they're my favorites to win the whole tournament, but this was a step in the right direction from a group stage that left a lot of questions for us. But, they got the job done and are into the semis.
Rachel, this was the most straightforward game of the quarterfinals, just given the two opponents who came into it. I'd say certainly probably the, I didn't look back at the betting odds, but I would guess the most lopsided in terms of one team being favored over the other. And then obviously the scoreline reflected that in ways that I think the other three matches did not. You have anything else to say about this game? And I guess just your thoughts on maybe Dan's point on this is still win the Gold Cup or bust for Tata Martino in this group, given the rest of the opponents left.
Yeah, I think that Mexico got the job done pretty early. They didn't really have to do too much in the second half but keep a clean sheet. So obviously there's so much credit that goes to the attacking players that just scored the goals and, of course, the coaches, and that's all very well deserved. But a huge, huge, huge credit to the defense, to the goalkeeper, Talavera, I hope I said that right, for keeping a clean sheet. Albeit Honduras didn't pile too many attacks on them, but still, defense got the job done. So good win for Mexico. And now they play Canada, which I feel like that's going to be just a weird game of soccer, but we'll see.
All right, let's move on to the other Saturday quarterfinal game that we had that featured Qatar, I guess the one invitational team in this tournament, and then taking on La Selecta, who Dan and I have been heaping so much praise on and being the fun team of the group stage. I want to apologize in advance, folks. My level of understanding and how to pronounce Arab and Muslim names is not very good, so I want to apologize for any mispronunciations that I have on Qatar players. I promise I will get that right by the time the Maroons take the field in their home country later next year. But Dan, I'll throw it to you first on this one. Qatar comes out and kind of stuns El Salvador. You know, the first 90 seconds, they get their first goal just 2 minutes in. Abdullah coming in from Afif and kind of not really a broken play, but really a nice counterattack in which El Salvador was kind of kept sleeping. And then an absolute banger from Mohamed 8 minutes later. Qatar had two real attacking sequences in the first 10 minutes, and both of them immediately led to goals. That kind of left El Salvador shell-shocked, and they were kind of figuring out, you know, getting their legs about them, their wits about them through the rest of the first half. Really sloppy play that leads to a penalty for Qatar on 55 minutes, and Abdullah converts that for his brace to make it 3-0 to Qatar at this point. Joaquin Rivas on a really great sequence where he kind of breaks through the line and then a well-timed pass for him to be onside in the 63rd minute. And then similarly, another goal in the 66th minute. El Salvador came back. I think they're probably kicking themselves for the fact that the first 10 minutes, maybe Qatar was a little bit lucky. Maybe Qatar just caught them napping on those two sequences and then they got punished for it. They showed up in terms of the performance by the end to actually get one, you know, that wasn't them getting blown out. But I think El Salvador has to think in this one that they were a comparable team to Qatar, that they did not, they didn't do themselves any justice. They didn't play as well as they were capable of in the first 10 minutes, and that set up the Qataris to play a very comfortable second half and kind of manage the game, given that it was a knockout stage match. And in that, El Salvador got punished in ways that they would have by Canada, by the U.S. and Mexico, and didn't deserve to get on. And the team that is the wild card hashtag Team Chaos team of the Gold Cup is through to the semis.
Yeah, Qatar has been surprisingly impressive in the attack. I do have some gripes, though, folks. I don't think that the penalty kick should have been given to Qatar. I thought this match should have been 2-2 at the end of extra time, at the end of full time and gone to extra time. I think it's incredibly poor for a referee to penalize a player for a ball that comes off his leg and rolls up and hits his hand, who in the direction of his movement would have been a natural position having the ball hit off his leg. I don't think it's the proper call. I think it's a terrible call. I won't go too far into my conspiracy theories. However, Qatar got the job done. Barely. They were barely able to survive. A couple of good saves in there from the Qatari keeper to get it done. They hang on against the El Salvador team that, honestly, folks, I know, you know, the U.S. is the first World Cup qualifiers against this La Selecta team. And this La Selecta team is good. They punch above their weight. They're scrappy. They create chances. They're good at scoring goals. And they've really threatened Mexico and then, honestly should have been level with Qatar after 90 minutes, after enduring a pretty, difficult opening 10, which, you know, one goal, kind of a fluky play that led to, the finish that Qatar got. And then at the same time, you have an absolute golazo that they scored, to make it 2-0. So, you know, I think Qatar, I won't say that Qatar doesn't deserve to be in the semifinals. I just have serious questions about that penalty kick. To me, it was incredibly dubious and harsh, to be given to Qatar for that. However, they capitalized on the chances that were in front of them. El Salvador wasn't as clean to start up the match. I feel like, you know, we saw this with El Salvador against Mexico and actually in all of their games so far in this tournament, is it takes them until the second half to really get going. I don't know what the slow start issue is for them. That might be a place where USA can kind of hit them when it comes to World Cup qualifying in September here. But, I have a hard time, writing off this La Selecta team because of just how good they are in the second half and how much fight they have. And the ability to get, goals, you know, all their goals were scored in the second half of this tournament. A lot of goals after the 80th minute as well. And they have some pretty good players and some key contributors that come from, experienced places in the U.S. So I think La Selecta and El Salvador should be very happy with their performance in this tournament. I think they put out some good performances. Qatar is still kind of shocking everybody here. I'm curious to see how it continues to play in this tournament. We'll talk more about their matchup against the U.S. men's national team in the semis, but, I think they also, as much as El Salvador probably deserved to be in the semis, so does Qatar, for how they've been able to create chances and score goals and get things done throughout this tournament, in a very entertaining fashion. So, props to Qatar, hat tip. But we also really have to acknowledge how good El Salvador has been this tournament, and acknowledge the threat that they pose when it comes to World Cup qualifying this fall and winter and spring next year.
Well said. Rachel, I want to throw it to you next. It seems like this happens in soccer in every single major tournament where a team maybe comes out of nowhere or does more than we were expecting or plays better than they are on paper or so one would think. And the fans or the members of the media or what have you or the neutrals fall in love or get behind them in the group stage and then ultimately we find out in their first knockout stage game that it was fool's gold, or maybe there was something else there that doesn't translate from the group stage to the actual knockout rounds. I remember that vividly from the MLS's back tournament just about a year ago now. Can't believe that it's been a year since the MLS's back tournament, in which Columbus Crew won all three of their group stage games, looked to be absolutely on power. You know, the Columbus Crew Twitter was making ZZ Top memes about Zelarayan and Zardes, and then they play Minnesota United, and they're out in the first knockout game. This summer, just a couple weeks ago, suddenly Dutch football was back, and Frank de Bust was back to being Frank de Boer. They get to the knockout stage, and they lose from the round of 16. Say what you will about some of the flashy moves and passes and highlight reel sequences that Cristiano Ronaldo had. He went out in the round of 16 with Portugal. Rachel, I can't tell you what one of the opponents were or what the scores were of any of the three group stage games for Russia. I can tell you that I remember very vividly their quarterfinal matchup that they have. How, within that mindset, what we remember about this El Salvador team? And more importantly, what we remember about your war daddy, Alex Roldan, helping them get there?
I was going to say, you can't have me talk about El Salvador without talking about Alex Roldan. The nice thing, I think, to your point about the tournaments is that with any sport, anything can change in a minute. Somebody could get injured, God forbid. People could just be off that day. Somebody could be on their total A game that you never would have expected. But the nice thing, I think, overall about this tournament in regard to World Cup qualifying is that it is CONCACAF aside from Qatar. You're playing CONCACAF teams. And in the group stage, they played CONCACAF teams. And they did well against CONCACAF teams. I mean, look at how they performed against Mexico. Granted, they lost, but oh my gosh, most teams like that wouldn't even hold a candle to Mexico. And yet El Salvador gave them problems pretty much the entire game. So I think this being a CONCACAF-based tournament and something like, you know, back in 2016 when you had the Copa America and the Gold Cup combined for, or not the Gold Cup combined. It was just the Copa America Centenario. My bad there. It's not something like that where you have a different federation coming in. This time you only just have one different team coming in. So I think this being a CONCACAF-based tournament is really going to help El Salvador. And I think, like Dan said, when it comes to World Cup qualifying, they are going to cause a lot of problems. And it goes without saying that I do think Alex Roldan has made this team a lot better in the midfield, which is an interesting position for him to play since he plays right back for the Sounders.
Well said. Let's move on to the Sunday games that we had that were a little bit more relevant from our coverage standpoint here at Last Word. Dan, I'll throw it to you first. Canada finally getting it done in the knockout stages against a team.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land. Can we just, like, sing the Canadian national anthem? Sorry. Go ahead.
We need to get Raheem's approval of that on and Mike's.
You know, when Sporting Kansas City has a Canadian team come to town, they have a guy normally who is from the Kansas City Opera that comes and does a incredible version of the Canadian of O Canada, and it's to the point where like Vancouver Whitecaps, the Montreal Impact have literally like tweeted out like, "Oh my gosh, this is like one of the best like versions of the national of O Canada we've ever heard." Like, thank you so much for like this really rousing rendition. And I got to watch all three games of Canada during the Gold Cup, and freaking CONCACAF just used some stupid, like, tracked, like, U.S. symphony band playing O Canada, and instead of having this wonderful singer do it, it was really frustrating. Anyway, sorry, Matt. Canada beat Los Ticos. They advanced in the quarterfinals.
Yes, goals from Junior Hoylett on the 18th minute and then Stefan Estaquillo in the 68th minute. Dominating performance from me, Dan, about even when it came down to possession. But you look at shots on target, passing in sequences in the final third and everything. Canada was clearly the team that was the more positive, the more attacking. They were the team that came out to actually play soccer against a Costa Rica team that, frankly, I don't know if they limped out of the group stage, but they were less than their usual selves that they're capable of being in this tournament. And we talked about this last pod, about this is the bugaboo, about where Canada can look pretty, have some good moments, you know, get the results, get the job done in the group stage. But when it comes up to going against a CONCACAF opponent that has had a better pedigree than them, that has been ahead of them over the course of this century since 2000, and a team that frankly has been there, done that, where Canada has been here and flopped, they ultimately fall flat on their faces. And this was an emphatic performance, this was an emphatic result, and a flattering 2-0 scoreline for the Canadians. And John Herdman can finally step up here and say, we didn't lose in the one game that we needed to get in order to get over our hump, and now we got a chance to go take a run at Mexico. Dan, your thoughts? And I mean, I just, how happy are we for our folks over in Canada that, you know, given how this team has fallen flat in the past, they finally got the result? And I guess to say nothing of the fact that Canada once again lost the Stanley Cup final.
I was very impressed with this Canada team. They've through the group stage, I really did think they had a really good shot at beating the U.S. men's national team. I thought it was going to be tight in that matchup. We saw how that went, but Stephen Eustachio was one of the most impressive players for me in that group stage. I just thought it was so criminal of him to pick up that. I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to play the long game and make sure his yellow card slate is wiped clean before the knockout round, so he doesn't pick one up against the U.S. and miss out against Costa Rica, or pick one up against Costa Rica and then miss out against Mexico. He's an incredibly important player to them. However, it's just like they could have avoided Mexico if Stephen Eustachio had played. And I think that was the most impressive thing from Canada against Los Ticos. You know, he was a huge part in that midfield in really breaking down what Costa Rica had. He had the crucial, he had a goal, had a crucial assist, played a really good game out of the midfield. This is a really good player who plays in a very technical league in Portugal, and, you know, has been in the Portuguese league for a while. I think also, you know, Costa Rica's group is relatively easy to think about it. USA looked pretty, the superior side against Jamaica in their matchup. And that was the toughest test that Costa Rica had in their group stage, you know? So I think, you know, Canada really got a hold of Costa Rica here. There are some that kind of made the argument that maybe we should see Canada as one of the top three. I refuse to believe that there is a top three in CONCACAF. It will always be Mexico, USA, and then a group of two or three teams who can, maybe be strong at times, and Costa Rica has long been a part of that. But right now, the most relevant player that Costa Rica has is Brian Ruiz, who is well aged out of, a serious playing contention, and Keylor Navas, who, is a fantastic goalkeeper, and for whatever reason, big teams in Europe just keep pushing him to the side for fancier and flashier names. Sooner or later, he's going to end up with someone that actually values him in Europe, and he's going to take them to heights that they don't quite deserve. Keylor Navas is the best player that Costa Rica has, and after that, there's a lot of question marks. And so, you know, I think this Canada team should be heralded for their win. They did a great job of getting past, but guess what? You chose to play the yellow card game. You missed Stephen Eustachio against the United States men's national team. And so now you have to play Mexico in the semifinals. And that's going to be, in my opinion, the biggest test of whether or not Canada is legit. If they can pressure Mexico, who I know have a few players that are of quality that are sitting at the Olympics right now with that team. But for the most part, this is a top choice Mexican national team, save Raul Jimenez, Diego Lainez, and a few others that are with the Olympic team. If Canada, without Jonathan David and Alfonso Davies, can put up a very difficult task for Canada or for Mexico in the semifinal match, then we can really have that conversation about Canada being a top three. But please let me know, you know, if you disagree here, but I think Canada has definitely solidified themselves within that next group of three or four teams outside of the USA. Mexico, and I think, have shown that they have a really legit shot to qualify for the World Cup in 2022.
Rachel, I'll throw it to you, your thoughts on the performance, and then I guess in the macro scale, I feel like Canada's in somewhat a similar situation to the U.S. in that, you know, Mexico is bringing their A team, they want to win the Gold Cup, everybody in the Gold Cup is setting, with the exception of Qatar, I should say, is setting themselves up for CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. Mexico's here to win it. They know that they're probably going to qualify. They're sending their team up for that. The U.S. is figuring out some of their roster moves with the hopes of qualifying, given what didn't happen in 2018. Canada, similarly, is trying to get the first team to gel, minus some key pieces in Jonathan David and Alfonso Davies, to actually qualify. And I feel like then there's a second tier of like Honduras and Costa Rica that are doing some roster turnover given their age and maybe aging out older veteran, not quite golden generations, but groups upon which that they were able to qualify for the World Cup the last two cycles. And then everybody else pretty much is on the outside looking in terms of realistically, you know, El Salvador is like, okay, we did a great job. We took a step up for this tournament. If we take another step up, we have a plausible chance at qualifying for the Gold Cup. I would say Jamaica is also in that category. Canada on paper has the talent, better than Costa Rica, better than Honduras, certainly behind the U.S. and Mexico. Given what they were able to achieve in this game, given the opportunity and maybe the test run, the barometer test that they have in the semifinal against Mexico, how are we feeling about the job that John Herdman's done? And in the context of this game, like, is this proof of concept we can plausibly go in and think we can qualify for the World Cup?
There was a lot there, Matt. First off, happy for my Canadian friends, sad for my Costa Rican friends. Really thought Costa Rica was going to win. Sorry to our Canadian friends, but I wanted Costa Rica to win. I think no matter what, the first thing I'll say is none of these teams are at their 100% full squad, the U.S. included, Costa Rica included, Canada included. So I think that needs to be taken into account as well. Not trying to, like, diminish or dumb down the Gold Cup by any means, but it's just a fact of the matter. What else did you say that I was going to speak on? Oh, John Herdman. I think Canada has built themselves up over the last couple years, not just months, but years, into a legitimate program. And you got to remember who the coach is. John Herdman led the Canadian women's national team through a few Olympics, in the 2015 World Cup. He's been there for a lot that the Canadian women have done in their successes. So he knows how to win games. He knows how to coach a winning team. And he knows how to coach Canadian teams. So I think Canada is in extremely good hands. But I remember being very shocked whenever he jumped ship to the men's side. But I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like if this team doesn't improve under him, then there's going to be a problem because he is a really, really, really good coach. He's kind of like Greg Vanney. He just kind of makes teams better wherever he goes. I don't know. I think Canada's improved a lot under him. We'll just see what happens in World Cup qualifying.
Let's move on to the nightcap that we had on Sunday now for the game for the majority of you, the listeners. And that, of course, was the United States. I don't know if, like, clumsy is the right word. Disjointed, I think, would certainly be appropriate. 1-0 result that they had against Jamaica. Matthew Hoppe with the hops in the 83rd minute to get the only goal in this one. But the field was pretty poor. We found it on the broadcast. I guess it was like a hybrid where they still had, I would assume, the Dallas Cowboys turf in there and then like stripped in with natural grass as well. The playing surface was uneven. It was clunky. The ball was bouncing weird. It ran weird. Players looked visibly upset and confused throughout the 90 minutes in terms of actually playing with it. CONCACAF gonna CONCACAF because, oh, it's the USA Jamaica, so Mexico's not here, so the field doesn't need to be good because we're CONCACAF and we don't pay for nice things during a pandemic of the only tournament that we actually make money on. So I guess in any case, Dan, I don't know that it's worthwhile for me to actually run down everything that happened, because it'd be me trying to find a plot in what was 90 minutes of chaos, or I guess 83 minutes of chaos, and then 7 minutes of the U.S. shutting it down. Dan, where do you want to – I'm not even going to ask you a question. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, let's start at the lineup. You know, I was actually very happy that he went to a 4-3-3 after the matchup against Canada. I said I wanted to see him in a 4-3-3 against Jamaica. Guess what they did? A 4-3-3 against Jamaica. Round of applause. Thank you for getting it right. You know, actually, I think it's kind of – I guess maybe it's validating to my own, like, personal views of how soccer should be played, that every single time I've watched the U.S. men's national team game, watching those three in person, after the first match, I said in my head, you know, that 5-3-2, whatever it was, looked really good at the end of that match against Haiti. Maybe they should use it against Martinique. Use it against Martinique, wipe the floor with them. They use it again against Canada, and you say, okay, against a higher opponent, they maybe don't have the personnel to run this right now with this roster. Let's go back to that 4-3-3 because they kind of did it at the end of the match. I really like Roldan or Areola out wide. Guess what he did? Put on Roldan, went to a 4-3-3, and the biggest thing, in my opinion, was that he put another ball winner with Gianluca Busio in the midfield, where it was just Busio, just Kellen Acosta and Legette as a 4-3-3, and I think that was really nice. The biggest thing for me, too, was in the second half when you dropped Busio to the six. My biggest problem with a significant amount of this roster is that they just want to go, 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 and it is the moment that they get a ball in the middle third, they're looking to play a long diagonal ball out wide or a ball over the top to whoever is striker. There is no patience, and with Kellen Acosta at the six, while he is a good kind of a destroyer, he goes and wins the balls and distributes and go. He is not the type, he doesn't have the passing array that Gianluca Busio has. We saw from Busio in the second half a very significant passing array. I know there was comments that, oh, Busio was really safe. Well, no crap when nobody from the midfield seemed relatively interested in keeping possession. He was the only one that was attempting to keep possession, so of course he's going to play it safe, try and make sure that they have the ball. He's not going to make chances and take chances in a dangerous area in the middle of the park. That's why young players always get pushed out wide, because mistakes out wide are less costly than chances in the middle. So, you know, there's some – once Busio goes back and plays a little bit further deep, they put a Kellen Acosta back forward up in the eight, and then they bring on Christian Roldan, who I think fits what you're looking for out of the right wing in this system as opposed to what Areola does. And it clicked. It looked really good for about 30, 40 minutes there. The U.S. men's national team was dominant, and I really am thankful to Greg Berhalter for sticking with Matthew Hoppe as long as he did out on the left wing, because the guy has deserved a goal for all the performances he's put in so far for the U.S. men's national team. He is a very talented player. He is the closest thing in this pool that we have to Clint Dempsey in terms of skill level, finishing ability, and the bravado and balls and ego to pull it off. We absolutely need more players like Hoppy in this system. I am very happy to see the confident and kind of saucy, arrogant side of him come out, because that dude is going to go over to the second Bundesliga and tear crap up for Schalke with that type of attitude and get them promoted. He might earn himself a bigger move, or he's going to be a fixture for Schalke going forward, which, considering Schalke's status within the Bundesliga in Europe, rough season last year. But if you told me 2 years ago that an American who was a cast off from the LA Galaxy Academy went to some random academy in Arizona that calls itself a Barcelona Academy but has no direct affiliation with Barcelona, I will disclose this. I am very high on a lot of the kids that come out of there, mainly because one of my high school teammates is the U16 coach in that academy as part of the MLS Next program. So he tells me, hey, watch out for this kid. 3 years ago, he told me, this kid, Matthew Hoppe's a freaking baller. I don't know why the Galaxy passed up on him. This guy knows what to do and be ready for it. I said, okay, cool. He told me, hey, he signed with Schalke. Pay attention. Okay. So then we see what happens when he gets his debut. We see the hat trick this season. Hoppy has a path that is exactly what the non-MLS Academy products are for in our system. And I won't go too deep into this right here. I don't want to go too far off track here. But, you know, Hoppy is the perfect success story for the U.S. Soccer Development Academy system and what it does and how it was designed to produce the pitfalls. Honestly, if anything, I have more questions about the LA Galaxy Academy, considering the amount of pros that they have not churned out, that came up through the Galaxy Academy or the Galaxy first team system, and those that have gone elsewhere and absolutely balled out. Hoppy is one of them. And so, props to Hoppy for, getting that goal. I'm excited for him. He is, as much as like the bravado comes out on the field, he's one of the most humble guys to talk to. And to me, that kind of like, that reminds me of Clint Dempsey in a way, because Clint Dempsey was arrogant on the field and he had this arrogant sauce, but you sit him down in front of a camera and he was a very honest, genuine guy from a humble background. And I think that's what made him so endearing in a way, especially to media, and to fans as well. And I'm just really looking forward to seeing the Hoppy trajectory after this match, because this, to me, this tournament's his coming out. That guy has to be involved in qualifying going forward. And he is a very serious candidate. If we ever needed to play Christian Pulisic in the middle, or Christian Pulisic was hurt, I would feel comfortable playing Hoppy out on the left wing, for that, because of the ability that he has shown in this tournament. I think he has to start in the game against Qatar.
Well said, Pimp. Rachel, I want to throw it to you. I guess, where do you want to start? Maybe the thing that we didn't talk about was maybe what Jamaica did to neutralize the U.S. and given the level of the playing field and the opponent and way the opponent played. Maybe this was a tougher test than we're making it out to be. Your thoughts on the performance, any individuals you want to highlight?
Well, I think first and foremost, they frustrated the United States, and that's what they intended to do. They went into the match, and they were like, all right, how can we frustrate them to the best of our abilities? There was that early substitution with a lot of, you know, CONCACAF-y stuff going on there. But I think Corey Burke did a pretty good job, despite the early yellow card, to kind of neutralize the United States. I've been a pretty big fan of, I don't know how to say his first name, Alvis Powell.
Yes.
Alvis Powell. I've been pretty impressed with him throughout the tournament. Tough to see Jamaica go in such a close-knit game. I really honestly thought that it was going to go into extra time to keep me past my bedtime. But thankfully it didn't. I agree with everything that Dan said about Matthew Hoppy. I think he is a wonderful player. He's really coming into his own. And, you know, he was kind of unknown a year ago today, and all of a sudden he shows up in these big moments, and that's the type of player that you need. That he knows, just like all the other players on the U.S. men's national team, that Greg Berhalter is picking players from this roster and from the Nations League roster and kind of meshing them in together during World Cup qualifying rosters. But back to Jamaica, I think Jamaica is a team, like Dan had alluded to earlier when talking about, well, you've got you've got Mexico, you've got the U.S., and then you kind of have those two or three other teams that kind of frustrate and push and try to make a run for their money. I think Jamaica has always played very physical soccer. That's just the type of soccer that they play, and they could really frustrate some teams in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying.
Well said, Rachel. I thought this was, in a way, kind of the perfect test for what the goal of this Gold Cup has been on a whole. You had a relatively familiar opponent, an opponent who's been used to playing the U.S. and has kind of gotten its groove together in terms of its identity. So relative to where Canada's trying to put it together for the stretch run, the other two games that you had were just against inferior opposition that we're going to play in a very predictable way. You know, Bobby Decadova-Reed has been in with the Jamaican national team for a number of years. They've got a handful of guys from Europe who've been integrated into the squad over the last World Cup cycle or so, and they've got some guys who've been in and around MLS and USL who are familiar with the American opponents that they're going to end up playing. Yes, Corey Burke can't match up 1v1 with Daryl DK or with Paul Areola at all that much, but I bet you he could have told the two center backs the type of player that they are from the time that he's played against them in MLS. So you had, I would say, the second most talented team that they've played after Canada in the group stage that has a very good camaraderie, a very good understanding of the style of play that they wanted to play, given the U.S. where they were at with the C team, given that they were playing given that they were kind of cobbled together and kind of asked to, yes, we're going to play as a team, but we're here really to evaluate a bunch of individuals and everything. You have that kind of coming through. And then I thought the playing surface ultimately played to the advantage of Jamaica, and it kind of took both teams 30 minutes to realize, all right, this isn't going to be a straight game. We just have to lump balls forward, and then it became Route 1 soccer. I thought the U.S. settled down in the second half. They had more of the ball. They had more of the chances created in the second half, but again, it still played into Jamaica's style of play because they were comfortable playing 4-4-2, have the front two antagonized in the press, at times one of the wide players depending on where the ball was, and then for the most part put six field players minimum behind the ball and then ask the U.S. to actually go beat them. And in that, it was a good representation of what an ugly, bad pitch game against Honduras, against Costa Rica, against Guatemala is going to look like with an actual competent opponent in this one. The U.S. could have easily lost this game, but ultimately it came down to, was somebody going to have, like what Dan said, the gumption, the bravado, the balls, the sauce to actually get done in the play? How many times did we see in World Cup qualification or a Gold Cup just a game that was a hot mess, nobody had anything going on, and it was just crying out for one person to take over the game, and then Jermaine Jones bosses the midfield for 20 minutes in order to get the U.S. a result and everything. And I thought Matthew Hoppe did that, and I thought a number of other individuals equipped themselves well or show how do they deal with chaos when nothing else is working around them. And in that, I think Shaq Moore continues to pass the smell test. Paul Areola, I thought, equipped himself really good. Dan, I thought you made some good comments about the good things and bad things that I think Gianluca Abbuccio and Kellen Acosta ultimately did in the midfield. But I thought this was just this was, I think, the first actual good barometer test of what some of these players are going to be like in World Cup qualification in weird CONCACAF-y moments. And I thought we got a good test of who's ultimately chosen that they're up to snuff and who's ultimately not up to snuff. Friends, anything else that we want to say about that, or shall we do USMNT stonk up and stock down? I'll take that silence as we're going to go. Dan, off of this game, give me one player stonk up, give me one player stonk down.
I will, as much as I hyped the crap out of Matthew Hoppe in our earlier section, I'm going to go with Gianluca Abbuccio. The whole complaint about Gianluca Abbuccio was, I'm imagine the SpongeBob meme as I'm saying this, but it's Matthew Doyle's, well, we're going to learn a lot about Abbuccio tonight. Is he going to win enough duels? The dude won 7 of 9 duels, 10 of 12 on the game. You can go shove it. Gianluca Abbuccio is in a system that does not play to possession. This U.S. Women's National Team is significantly more direct than Sporting Kansas City is. If you watch him with Sporting Kansas City, you say, hey, he doesn't need to win all of those duels. I will say this, though. Abbuccio does need to win duels. That's his job. That's part of the job in the midfield. As any midfielder, regardless of you are a peer number 10, you have to be able to win the ball back and understand some of the pressing triggers. That is what he does so well at the number 6, because he is like a really, he is a magician and a maestro when he sees the ball. He is the closest thing that I think America and the U.S. men's national team may ever see to Andrea Pirlo. I'm dead serious. The guy reminds me of an Andrea Pirlo type. Pirlo was a 10 without being this incredible dribbler, this incredible significant goal scoring threat. He could play deep. He could play as an eight. He could play as a 10. He could play anywhere in the midfield. But the biggest thing that Pirlo had was this ability to him. And if Busio can ever marry the maestro with a sense of physicality, reminder, Busio's like 5'8 and maybe like 180 pounds soaking wet. Like, I am as tall as Gianluca Busio. Gianluca Busio is listed at 5'8. I am as tall as Gianluca Busio and I am 5'6. I have talked to this man in person multiple times. You know, he is not going to be a Weston McKennie type. That's just not him. But he is this kind of attacking guy that I see a lot of maestro type ability from him, and what I've seen with Sporting Kansas City, what I see now with U.S. men's national team and his player type, he just reminds me so much more of an Andrea Pirlo type than he does a true eight, a true 10, a true six. Pirlo was kind of positionless in the midfield, and I think that's kind of where Busio was at. But I think his stock up was because of how feisty he was in this game. It was great to see him kind of get his elbows a little dirty there, get physical with Jamaica, and then he eventually took hold of the game's tempo and the distribution from deep later in the second half. My stock down on this one is actually going to go with Sebastian Lletget. Sebastian Lletget is one of the worst passers out of the midfield that I have seen in a U.S. men's national team shirt. I am sick and tired of seeing him playing long diagonals to wingers who have zero speed to get past their fullback, and set pieces that, frankly, Gianluca Busio is one of the main reasons why Sporting Kansas City has been so dangerous on set pieces the last 2 years. There's no reason Sebastian Lletget should be taking set pieces over him. The guy's placement is significantly better than Legette's. I'm sick and tired of seeing Lletget as a number eight, and this kind of, like, it's almost like Berhalter thinks Lletget can do what Busio does, and he can't. So for me, honestly, I was really disappointed with Lletget's performance last night. I thought he didn't really provide what I was hoping he would provide in the attack. And I think his distribution out of the midfield was really, really poor. I wonder, you know, we see a lot of things from Lletget with the full national team that we're like, hey, we kind of like these things. But he's the kind of player that, like, you forget about when you have to focus on Gio Reyna, Yunus Musa, Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie, Sergiño Dest, and Christian Pulisic. But when you ask him to be the true main facilitator and the true main the 8.5 in this Berhalter system of the 4-3-3, I don't think he has the chops to do it. I've yet to see that. I think he would be better suited as a number 10 in a double pivot. I don't want to see him creating from deep any longer. So for me, Lletget, Dubois, I like him. I think he's a good player. I think he has to be a part of World Cup qualifying. I don't like how he's been used and how the performances he has put on in the Gold Cup.
Rachel, USA versus Jamaica, stonk up, stonk down.
I can't take you guys seriously when saying stonk. But I also love
it. Stonks.
So my stonk up is on defense, Miles Robinson. Thought he had a much better, much more clean game against Jamaica last night. But I was just taking a quick look at his stats too, and he had a pass succession rate of, I think, 85 or 86%. That's really good. And I know that Greg Berhalter in these formations, he likes to start from the back and play up. There are some coaches that don't like to do that, but Greg has always been very big on starting from the back and moving the ball up. I thought he played a much better game. He was very clean on defense. Jamaica took, I think, 9 or 10 shots, but not too many were on target, and a lot of that was because of Miles Robinson. I think he had a good partnership with Sands in the back. And my stomp down, I don't really have too much to say on this one because he didn't really do too much. But Paul Areola was pretty boring on the right wing. He didn't take a single shot. He wasn't really creating many chances like he usually does. So I thought them pulling him close to, I think, the 60-minute mark was probably a good step. So I think for me, his stonk went down.
For me, my stonk up is Matthew Hoppe. I guess it's the obvious one from this game. You know, retweet, smash the retweet button on everything that Dan said just a couple minutes ago. My stonk down might be a little controversial given who my stonk up is. And I'm going to go with Gerald Ekman, who had, you know, I think a frenetic opening 20 minutes against Martinique, had a fantastic goal in the second half on this one. But we wanted to see what he could do equipping himself in the group stage game. Wasn't super impressive, and for a game that was crying out for somebody to do something in the offensive third, in the box, for either team to ultimately decide the game, he was, you know, he wasn't great for me. And I say that knowing that I don't think the team around him also didn't really put him in a position to be successful. But I think we've kind of seen, kind of unfortunately, DK's kind of been the same victim that we also have seen from other players in the past. You know, I would say this happened to Christian Pulisic a couple years ago, and I mean, we've done every single year that there's a, you know, a new opportunity or a new player coming in, and there's a new wonder kid or somebody, there's a young player who then, based on where their potential could be or where they're perceived of what their ceiling is, then USMNT Twitter projects its hopes, its desires, and that expectation and the weight of expectation of that potential onto that player. And I think in USMNT Twitter, knowing what we have in Giassi Zardes, moderate floor, not really a high ceiling. Jozy Altidore, we don't know whether or not it's going to be fit. Sargent does a lot of really good things off the ball, but he has not scored goals for the U.S. national team. People have been underwhelmed by his numbers for Werder Bremen, even though that team was entirely crap about around him, and I'm not sure that he could have rescued them from relegation and everything. I think we see all of that and we think, oh, we need somebody to be the savior. And then so because of what DK did with Marnsley and was overperforming his XG, and because of where we perceive his ceiling to be at in, you know, Orlando City setting the price tag for him at $20 million, then we assume that he is that or is immediately going to be that on the field. And he has not been that. Keep in mind, folks, it has been just over right around a year ago today that he made his professional debut for Orlando City. The kid is still raw. The kid still has many, many years in order to develop. Obviously not a lot of time if we're talking about World Cup qualification, but given that he was given an opportunity in this tournament to audition for, you know, Greg Berhalter saying, show me something that makes me think you are plausibly the starting striker for us when we get to World Cup qualification. And I've been underwhelmed, and I'm still not sure that we have an obvious answer there. As I talked about, there's pros and cons by each one of those players involved there, but I don't think it's obvious in the same way that I think Shaq Moore has clearly worked his way into the fullback discussion. And, you know, Greg Berhalter has a number of different options there. I think Miles Robinson will be in the conversation, especially if Walker Zimmerman's injury keeps him out for an extended period of time next to that John Brooks role. And I think Matthew Hoppe has very, very clearly said, you know, you need insurance for Christian Pulisic not playing 270 minutes in CONCACAF in 9 days. I am your guy for that. And the door was wide open for there to Daryl DK to walk through, and he didn't do it against Jamaica. In theory, he's got another 90 minutes to prove it against Qatar. With that, folks, let us go to the roundtable where we will be doing pick-ems. Dan, I'll throw it to you first. We'll start with Mexico taking on Canada. Both of these CONCACAF Gold Cup semifinals will take place this coming Thursday, the 29th, folks. And Mexico-Canada will be at NRG Stadium, home of the Houston Texans of the NFL, at 10 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dan, who you got? What's the score land and why?
As many nice things as I said about Canada, I'm gonna take Mexico in this one by a score of 3-1. Davies and Jonathan David maybe make this a closer matchup, but not these days. I'll take Mexico in this one. They really seem to find their gear against Honduras. And I'll take this one. What is it? Did I say 3-1? But 3-1 will be my final say.
Rachel.
I'm going to go Mexico 2-0. I think it's just the obvious choice there. Dulce Cierto.
I'll take Mexico by a score of 2-1 in this one. I think Canada will show themselves better than they did against Mexico when I saw them in person at the Gold Cup here at Mile High Stadium in the group stage. So I think they'll have a performance that shows that they've made progress and that John Herdman can spin into being a positive and a good lesson learned. But Mexico is the better team. They're the better team on paper. And I've got some doubts against that Mexico backline with Lucas Cavallini not being able to play in this one. And I think that'll be just enough for Mexico to win against what will be a feisty and emboldened Canadian team. And then move on to the other game that we have, 7:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1. This will be at the Treehouse in Austin, Texas. The U.S. national team heading into the green seats to take on the maroon team. So we'll have a weird smattering of colors going on here. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to take the U.S. national team in this one. Really, I thought Qatar would be, or Jamaica would be their trap game. So far, La Selecta has been the best team that, Qatar has faced. And honestly, if the U.S. national team faced off against El Salvador, I probably would have picked the U.S. national team to win. So, I'll take the U.S. national team in this one. I'm going to say it's going to be a little crazy though. It'll be a score by a 2-1. But I think this is going to be one where the U.S., maybe gets ahead, a little early and has to weather the storm as Qatar, pushes for it. I think there's places, for Qatar to be had. And I think a player like Busio, if they can slow down and play through him, and not be so aggressive and trying to play diagonals, over the top, I think that will really, really help the team, against Qatar.
Rachel.
I'm going to go Team Chaos on this one. I'm going to go 1-1 draw, heading into extra time, 1-1 draw, heading into penalties. I don't know why, but I really, really, really feel like it's going to be just a sludge fest of CONCACAF mess. Yeah. And then the U.S. wins on penalty kicks.
Who scores the winning PK, Rachel, or do you have a Matt Turner special winning it?
I was going to say, I feel like Matt Turner is going to have a special and win it, but I just feel like, I don't know, it's going to be one of those things, this is oddly specific, where, like, the U.S. is going to, like, miss one, and then Qatar is going to miss one, and then Matt Turner is going to make a save, and the U.S. is going to win.
Okay, then. I will take the United States by a score of 2-1 in this one, and I will say that it will take 120 minutes, so we will be 1-1 at the end of the 90, and then the U.S. will score in extra time. You know, I think Qatar's equipped themselves well in this tournament, and I think the fact that they play a counter-attacky 5-3-2 with the wingbacks is going to be problematic for the U.S. given where the offense has come. I think it's going to be difficult for the fullbacks, Vines and Shaq Moore, overlapping to create really anything. And I also think Matthew Hoppe's equipped, just numbers-wise, Qatar is going to be able to handle that and cover space and chase down balls. That being said, I do think there are going to be wide open holes in the midfield. And I think unlike where Jamaica was very good and capable of pressing the U.S. and the field was also crap, we've seen at least so far in MLS play that it's been a pretty decent pitch for Austin FC for their home games, obviously with Josh Wolf, who, you know, if you want an answer to the question, who's the head coach trying to play the most like the U.S. national team in MLS, it's Austin FC and Josh Wolf. So they've had a pitch at a field that has been managed for them to play out of the back and to pass and keep the ball on the ground and play link-up play. I have to assume that that pitch is going to be way better suited to what the U.S. is going to want to do in this game than sure what they had at Jerry World the other night. And so I actually think, well, I would make some changes in terms of the, you know, we'll see what happens from a health standpoint at center back. Maybe they rotate guys out. Honestly, I, you know, Dan, interrupt me if you disagree, but I'd start the same three midfielders in this one because I want the same guys who are going to be able to pass the ball and then move the ball into space. And I think given that they're going to have an even numbers in terms of three in the midfield, in terms of a 5-3-2 for Qatar and a 4-3-3 from the United States, that's going to equip them better. It's just going to be a matter about them going up the middle. And in that, I think that's where it's going to be a bit of a slog. And I think, ironically, folks, they're not going to like this. Maybe this is me being a Zardes apologist here. I think Giassi comes off the bench in stoppage time and gets the winner after Daryl DK is a battering ram for the better part of, you know, 90, 95 minutes or so. That'll do it for us, folks, since tomorrow is our main content. Let's go on to Last Word. Rachel, I will throw it to you first. Do you have any last words, and where can people find you on Twitter?
Very minimal last words for me. Find me on Twitter, at RachelKruger. And the only thing I have to say is check out Matt and I tomorrow night. We're going to be recording tomorrow night, talking about the U.S. Women's National Team. They play in just a few short hours at the ungodly time of 4:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Thank you, Lord, for the record and the DVR button, because your girl needs some sleep and she'll watch it later. They play Australia in just a few hours. Should be a win for the U.S. Women's National Team. We'll see. But Matt and I are going to be chatting lots of WOSO coming up.
Dan, Dub of the Week, L of the Week, where can people find you on Twitter? And then tell our good listeners about Icarus FC.
Yeah, so my L of the Week going to go to JT Marcinkowski. JT Marcinkowski is the goalkeeper of Santa Eric, for those of you who don't know. In this matchup on Wednesday night against Sporting Kansas City, there was a very odd sequence of plays where Johnny Russell was in the box. He got taken down, but there was an attempt at contact made that forced Johnny Russell to go to the ground. However, he came back up with the ball, was searching and trying to place it in. Head referee in this match, Justin Dickerson, who is notably not on any weekend assignment after his delightless performance in the San Jose Earthquakes Sporting Kansas City matchup on Wednesday night, called a penalty kick. And then it went to VAR after a significant protest from the San Jose Earthquakes. He overturns the penalty kick due to Law 8, as was meant, was told to me finally, in the referee's post-game, whatever it's called, pool reporting, via the pool report, who, aka, I'm your boy, the pool reporter for Kansas City. I asked the question of why. So what happened was the ball got dropped to JT Marcinkowski, despite Sporting Kansas City having possession of the ball inside the box, at the time of the penalty kick call. The rule is that any, according to Law 8, is that any ball that is dropped with inside the penalty box, in the 18 is automatically dropped to the defending goalkeeper, regardless of who had possession in the 18. Then it is up to JT Marcinkowski to be the sporting person and launch the ball back to the Sporting Kansas City to allow them to regain possession. However, up 1-0 in the 90th minute and in desperate need of 3 points, as the San Jose Earthquakes have borderline 10-11 games without a win, JT Marcinkowski opted not to do so and tried to keep possession with the San Jose Earthquakes. The San Jose Earthquakes predictably gave up possession to the ball against Sporting Kansas City because they are terrible at keeping possession against good teams who could press them. Cam Duke made a driving run through the heart of midfield. Judson takes him down, picks up a second yellow card for a professional foul. Luckily, honestly, he was about 3 or 4 fouls away prior that he probably could have gotten his second yellow card. That didn't happen. He gets the red, gets sent off, and then the moment of karma happens. Johnny Russell takes a free kick that goes off the post, off the back of JT Marcinkowski, right into the path of 3 on rushing Sporting Kansas City attackers. Daniel Shallowy made sure he was the first to that ball over under Fontes and Kyrie Shelton. Not one San Jose Earthquakes member mentioned a move to that ball. The L of the week goes to JT Marcinkowski for choosing to not be a sportsman in that, and return the possession to the Sporting Kansas City, who definitely deserved to have possession of that situation because of the referee's incompetence. I don't think it was a penalty call that ever should have been called on Johnny Russell's contact. It took away a very clear scoring opportunity from Sporting Kansas City. Peter Vermeesel mentioned it afterwards, was not fined. That is usually when Peter Vermeesel goes on when coaches in MLS go on a significant post-game rant, and do not pick up any fine, that is usually MLS's acknowledgement that they are in the right. And the fact that Joseph Dickerson was not down any sort of assignment, not even as a fourth official or VAR or head official, for MLS this weekend, that tells you that MLS says, yeah, sorry, we effed up. This was a really poor refereeing performance. And, we'll take the L on that one. So while L of the week goes to JC Marcinkowski, Dub of the week goes to Peter Vermees for avoiding an MLS fine, disco fine, in absolutely lambasting Dickerson for one of the worst officiating performances I have seen in person in a really long time. I have made a vow this entire season to not really judge referees and allow them to be human in their mistakes, but there was just a significant amount of game-changing mistakes that were made by the refereeing crew in this match, and it was a horribly inconsistent match. I think both Almeida and the fact that both usually when both head coaches lament referees after the post-match, that's usually like the sign that like maybe the referee did a good job. And if you go back and watch the tape, it's just the sign that the referee had zero control of the game. It was consistently inconsistent. There was no clear boundary of what was a foul, what was a yellow card, and what was even a red card. Jalen Lindsey took a knee to the head and got a yellow card for sliding in and getting the ball in that tackle. I don't know how to tell you how terrible that officiating performance was, but I think it'll be a few weeks before we see Joseph Dickerson on the side in the center circle in an MLS match. Anyways, my reffing rant is over. Now I want to tell you folks about Icarus FC. If you're tired of the same old uniforms, cookie cutter templates from Nike and Adidas, are you looking for a completely unique or custom kit for your youth club, Sunday league squad, adult, or even pro team? Icarus FC can help you create the kit of your dreams at an affordable price with the motto, any design you want. Seriously, let them help you design your new custom kit today at IcarusFC.com. Matt, tell us about the Rocky Mountain Cup and what the heck happened on that first goal.
That's a really good question for William Yarbrough. I am not William Yarbrough. The only thing that I can say about what happened there, Dan, is I'd like to officially congratulate Jared Watts and Tim Howard for no longer being involved in the worst own goal in the history of the Colorado Rapids. That own goal being in a 1-1 draw, or I think they actually lost 1-0 to DC United under then interim coach Steve Cook after that would have been the first home game after Paolo Mascherini was dismissed from the club in 2017. I guess just a lapse of concentration where I guess he thought he had the ball and then it just clicked off the inside of his heel and then back in because he wasn't looking for it. It wasn't really pressure. William Yarbrough has been a great addition to the Colorado Rapids. This is the first genuine bad moment that he's had as a player that's actually cost the Colorado Rapids. And I look forward to him returning. I look forward to him bouncing back this coming weekend, maybe with the helps of a sports psychologist. If somebody can help Danny Rojas, then I'm sure there's somebody out there who could help William Yarbrough. But that kind of, you know, that unsettled the Rapids and I think unfortunately restarted and resurrected the narrative, what has been the narrative around the Colorado Rapids going to the Rio T in the first leg of the Rocky Mountain Cup, losing badly, not looking like themselves. RSL playing above what their run of form had been to that point and then setting themselves up for a very comfortable situation and clinching the trophy. So, I think a lot of people on Rapids Twitter and in Rapids land thought that last year was, them turning the corner, 5-0 victory at Rio Tinto, first time that they had won at the Rio T, first time winning the Rocky Mountain Cup since Rio Tinto as a stadium had opened and their first time scoring more than two goals in Sandy, Utah as well. It's like, okay, fine, the curse is broken, the mojo's gone, the team's figured it out. Demir Krylach didn't absolutely hammer the team or anything. He didn't look like a $30 million player against the Rapids. RSL, for some reason, didn't play better against the Rapids than they have against everybody else. Finally, we end that narrative, and that narrative came back, and unfortunately, it was started by a self-inflicted wound. So I have some serious doubts about whether or not the Rapids can win the Rocky Mountain Cup. The teams will play three times this year, but per Rocky Mountain Cup, the gang of 10, group of 10, I think it was, between the five members of the Salt Lake City United and then the five members of Centennial 38 at the time voted, it would just be the first two home games between the teams. So not a third leg, given that one team would have a home field advantage. There is a stipulation in the rules that if they are tied on aggregate, and then the away goals record, and then it's not decided on away goals, then in a tie, it is retained by the team that has won it. So in theory, the Rapids later this year could beat RSL by a score of 3-0, and then tie 3-3 on aggregate, 0-0 on away goals, and the Rapids would retain the Rocky Mountain Cup. But unfortunately, that nightmare was restarted by the Rapids when you thought that the Rapids would have slain those demons last year. Listeners, I want to thank our other sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, who are an official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. They are also doing customizable summer scarves, customizable masks to the extent that we're still needing to wear those with the Delta variant out there. Folks and people still going to sporting events and other things where masks may or may not be required. And then we also, they also are making neck gaiters as well. So get your custom, all of that for your group, team, or office at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at @LWSMattPollard. Last word on sports.com/soccer for all of our content, Gold Cup, U.S. Women's National Team at the Olympics, and MLS all season and all year long. And you can follow us on all the socials at LastWordSC. Rate, review, share, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Just on your favorite podcatcher, search LWS or Last Word Radio. You'll find us and a bunch of other great content from our Last Word on Sports Radio family. Listeners, we'll see you hopefully later this week between the semifinals and the final to preview what I hope will be a USA versus Mexico final at the Death Star in Las Vegas, Texas. We'll see you then.